Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. Matthew Kennedy has written about the fall of the big-budget Hollywood musical and three biographies of Hollywood figures, the actresses Marie Dressler and Joan Blondell, and the director Edmund Goulding. His new book is part biography, part appreciation, and all enthusiasm for the films of Elizabeth Taylor, and he's here today to talk about his book on Elizabeth Taylor, An Opinionated Guide, published in 2024 by Oxford University Press. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Dan, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's start with something from your book before we get into the structure. You say that you first saw Elizabeth Taylor in Taming of the Shrew and that she has, and this is your words, entranced you like no other actress. Why?
I'm not, that's not a completely easy answer, easy question to answer, because it sort of encompasses the sort of ethereal quality that she has as a movie star, and part of the majesty of her and other select movie stars is that they defy easy description. I just know that they affect me on a kind of primal cellular level. And that's certainly the case with her. I can sort of try to take it apart and remember that as a 10-year-old kid, at the Cascade Theater in my hometown of Reading, watching Taming of the Shrew, which I have a vivid memory, huge single screen, right? In the old days before theaters were subdivided. And that first shot of her in Taming of the Shrew is of one of her eyes peering through a slightly open door. And I've just never forgotten it. It's, first of all, she had magnificent eyes that were referred to as violet by many people. Plus, just beyond that, within the show, within that film, she had a kind of energy and a kind of charisma, again, as a 10-year-old budding cineast, that I found completely enthralling. And that she's one of those people who, even on a screen as big as the one I saw as a kid, she filled it and then some. And many people on a big screen get kind of lost for me because they're simply not charismatic enough. And that's when I realized, many years later, that what I was seeing was true and genuine movie star power. And perhaps she was the first that affected me that way. And I've just never really let go of that feeling for her in all the films of hers I've seen since. So, yeah, but it does come down to something that's really hard to define in terms of, yeah. And that's what keeps me coming back, you know? And again, other stars for me have that quality, but she, for me, was the first. And I think arguably nobody, and maybe in the history of movies, has ever epitomized or personified the notion of the movie star more than Elizabeth Taylor. That might be somewhat forgotten today, but history and a look back at film history, I think, might support that idea. So, but that being said, the book is not just an examination of that elusive magical quality known as movie star, the thing that we say, I know it when I see it, even if I can't, really clearly articulate what it is. But the book is also, maybe even more so, dedicated to really trying to study her as an actress. And the point being that, we think of her as this great movie star and certainly this amazing celebrity, and later on in her life, a philanthropist, but she was also an artist and she was making artistic decisions as the camera was rolling. And she had a very long career and she was extremely knowledgeable about film technique. And all of that seems to be somewhat neglected in her legacy. And that's what I decided to focus on in the book.
Yeah, you make so many good points there, because that's one thing that occurred to me when I read it, was that, the difference between some people are great movie stars, but they might not be a great actor, or vice versa, right? And that we all just took it for granted that she was just always around. Like she was like, she was just, who was she? She's Elizabeth Taylor. She's this bigger than life person. And you reminded me just now in your answer about in Sunset Boulevard, when Gloria Swanson says, they had faces then, and that there's no one like Elizabeth Taylor now, because the world is full of beautiful people. But she had this thing, like you said, when you first see her eye in Taming of the Shrew, that's a big, big moment where even as a 10-year-old, your brain is trying to figure out, well, what makes this person different? So let's.
Well, yeah, it went straight into my whatever the cerebral term is for deep memory.
Yeah, that's great. So let's talk about Camille Paglia. She calls her the mythic female, and you call her, and I just love this. This is page two of the book. You say she was always fun. She was always fun. And I thought to myself as I read that, that's a great adjective for her. So can you talk about that your word choice there?
Well, Dan, thank you for lighting on such a basic word, and and getting a lot out of it. What I read repeatedly, and what I think comes across on the screen, at least in select performances, is that she was someone who simply wanted to enjoy life, and that also meant the life of a film set. So repeatedly, from directors and co-stars and crews, I heard that she was very kind, very self-deprecating, very generous, and that she had an ability to diffuse tense situations. And what I thought about in terms of that is that if you're a working actor, which she also was, right, as well as a movie star, she set her alarm and she got up and she went to work for years and years and years. Is that, this is gig employment, right? I mean, especially after the studio system. And that must cause a great deal of stress among crew, among cast. I don't know if I'm going to get I don't know if this is my last job, right? I mean, something may go wrong and this is it. And that's going to cause some tension on the set. And Elizabeth, I think, was, again, according to accounts I've read, very, very good at minimizing that stress and allowing people to have a good time in the moment, which of course meant that they're going to work better. And it was probably for her benefit as well. And also because the size of her celebrity, especially later, well, maybe throughout her career, she knew that she had a power over people. She knew that she had an intimidation, that people were gushing or tongue-tied in her presence, regularly. And she didn't necessarily like that. She was a very down-to-earth person. And so she, I think, created techniques and approaches on the set that made people at ease, despite, again, the blinding magnitude of her celebrity.
Right, because you can imagine how daunting it was to show up and walk on the set and be with Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, time and again, you're walking onto a set and like, that's a I'm gonna share a scene with Elizabeth Taylor. Are you kidding? And she knew it was in everybody's best interest to just be, one of the gang.
Right.
And I read that over and over again about her.
That's great. So let's get into some of her films. So she made 56 films, 10 TV movies. She was in two stage productions, did 12 guest spots on TV, including, of course, Maggie Simpson's voice. That's a great thing I got to explain to my kids. You know who Maggie is? Elizabeth. And the kids are like, "Well, who's Elizabeth Taylor?" And you're like, "Oh,
Right.
darn." But you point out that level of, and we mentioned this before, almost like that saturation level of celebrity is gone. And you make the point where, because when I read this, I'm like, well, what about Taylor Swift? What about people now? But you say this, and I want to get your reaction to this. You say, quote, "No one will ever have such star machinery behind her again, and that film stars don't simply have the central place in society that they used to." So what was she the last of? Can you talk about that? Like, why isn't she coming back?
Well, she was the last of the a great and mighty studio invented star. So what's remarkable about her is that she came in, she was a child in the 1940s, and that was at the height of the studio system when you had older stars who were deeply attached to that form of filmmaking and so forth. She comes in as a child, but then survives the breakup of the studios into the era of independent production. And so she had this association with classic filmmaking, and yet was younger than a lot of the certainly younger than the Gables and the Garbos and so forth by a long shot. But the marketing that went into creating her stardom was enormous, and actually rather centrally located, if you will, because it came from MGM. She was there for 18 years, and they invented her essentially as a star and as an actress. They told her who to date, they told her what movies to make, they told her how to dress and how to carry herself and so on and so forth. She eventually rebelled against that. But also, I think what's changed and why that level of celebrity will never come back, or at least it's hard to imagine, is because popular culture has been splintered in so many directions today. So in the old days, in the days of Elizabeth Taylor, you went to the movies. You didn't see them on TV. You certainly didn't see them on your phone. You went to a big theater and you saw them, and there's this larger than life mythic creature up there, and then you enjoyed it, and so you saw the next one and the next one and the next one. And maybe you saw films on TV, but you knew that that was an inferior experience because they'd be chopped up with advertisements and so forth. And they might show up 3 years after they were first run, maybe 5 years, maybe not at all. So going to the movies was this great ritual, and centering our lives around, if you love movies, around movie stars. And being able to discuss them Monday morning at work was simply, I think, a more pervasive communal experience in the old days, in the Elizabeth Taylor days, than it possibly could be today. Taylor Swift is a major, major celebrity. I don't know that she engages as broad a cross-section of modern life as Elizabeth Taylor did. And
Right.
I don't know that anybody ever will again.
Yeah. Well, to go back to push a point, it's again like Sunset Boulevard, like she was big, it's the pictures that got smaller.
Right. Well, and in her case, her pictures got smaller, but
It
that's another story.
did.
But her celebrity didn't. Her
Right,
celebrity
that's true. And what you
never, ever dimmed.
And what you point out too is so true. It's like today the film going experience is so fragmented, where everyone is now you can watch whatever you want as much as you want. You don't have to talk to anyone else about it. I'm on third season of this, or I've seen this one. So it's so hard to find that communal kind of experience.
Well, that's you bring up another good point, which is that maybe we're sharing things, but we're not necessarily sharing them at the same time. A movie opens in the 1950s, like Giant, for example, and you go see Giant, right? And
Everybody
then you
does.
talk about it, and you're just not with the program if you have if you wait a month. You are going to wait in the long line that in the first 2 weeks. Otherwise, it's going to go by. And you don't know if you'll ever see it again. And it's this huge phenomenon. And That again, that creates a wonderful cohesive popular culture that we don't have. Like, oh, I'll see that when it when I can stream it, why go to a theater? That so yeah, that's I
Absolutely.
think that's
So let's talk about her films, and let's talk about what I think is a wonderful, wonderful structure of your book. I mentioned before that the subtitle, it's called On Elizabeth Taylor, but I love this part, An Opinionated Guide. So you are certainly not the first person to say, I'm going to write a book about Elizabeth Taylor. You probably won't be the last, but I think your book does something that's wonderful, and I think it's engaging, and it's a lot of fun. And I'd like you to tell the listeners about what is the Matthew Kennedy approach to Elizabeth Taylor?
Dan, I'm thank you for that question and that approach from you. Actually, the opinionated guide is comes from a series, a kind of informal series that's happening at the publisher of the book, Oxford University Press, where they are asking various writers to do career assessments of major artists. The first one was Stephen Sondheim by Ethan Mordden, and then he did one on Barbara Streisand, and there haven't been many yet. So I was approached to do this on Elizabeth Taylor or on a movie star, and I thought it was my idea to do Elizabeth Taylor, but the format of the book, it was indeed so much fun to write because I simply took all of her films and wrote individual essays on each one of them. So I was freed from the burden as a somebody who's done biography of a book length flow between chapters. It was more like here, she did The Last Time I Saw Paris. She did National Velvet. If they're separate essays, if you read them one after the other chronologically, there will be a flow of sorts, but it's a professional flow, right? It's she went from this movie to that movie to that movie. You can get a sense of her progression and maturity as an actress. But it was so the opinionated guide part was that it is not simply a reference book that talks about, she worked with this director and it made this amount of money and the reviews were this and so forth. It's actually what do I think her performance brings to the film? Where do I, where, how does this performance impact the arc of her career? What perhaps was going on in her private life at the time that impacts what we see on screen? So the focus is really, with each film, is actually even not the film itself, but what she brings to the film. There were times as a writer where I was so tempted to deviate into, well, the director was having a nervous breakdown, or, the studio was running out of money, or whatever. And I said, I had to keep myself on track and say, Matt, it's about Elizabeth. It's about her performance. It is about what she brings to the screen. Everything else is secondary. And that, I hope, brings a somewhat fresh perspective to her and her films, given that, as you alluded to, Dan, there are already quite a few books on Elizabeth Taylor,
Right.
right? So the challenge at the onset was, how do I make this different? How can I approach her very larger than life legacy in a fresh way?
Yeah. Well, before you said that she was fun, and your book, the fun of your book is, of course, is that this is how I imagine every human is going to read this book. You go to your favorite movies by her. Okay, let's see what he said about this movie. Okay, let's. Oh yeah, that's the season of that movie. And then you see other ones. You're like, oh, I forgot she was in that. And then you see other movies where you're like, I didn't even know about this movie. Like, so that's what the fun is. It's like the flipping around part makes it fun to go through.
Well, I certainly hope that's the effect. I
Yeah.
mean, that anybody who loves her, maybe even loves classic Hollywood,
Yeah.
will have it on their shelf and say, "Oh, that's an Elizabeth Taylor movie." Well, yeah, exactly. What does Kennedy have to say? And also, I kind of expect that there's going to be a kind of a conversation going on because the fact that it's an opinionated guide makes it singular. It's like I fully expect that people are going to read this and go, he really he liked that performance, or he liked that movie, or oh wow, I thought that was a great movie and he's just kind of lukewarm. Or I do try to make a distinction, of course, between the film and her in it. And often there is a disjuncture there between, you know, I'm thinking she's bringing a lot to a movie that doesn't have, that isn't really supporting her very well, is, you know, it is also very often the case. So I try to make that distinction, but I fully expect that. And I even welcome it. I mean, that's the point. We all have opinions, right? I just have this amazing, had this amazing privilege to be able to publish mine.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
The dream job of the 10-year-old who saw Taming of the Shrew is to watch those movies and just spout off on them and give your opinions. Sold.
Exactly. Well, I sometimes pinch myself and say, I can't believe my 10-year-old self can't believe can hardly believe I've actually done this, right? Like,
yeah. So before we get into some of the actual movies, I just want to ask you another overall question before we dive in a little more deeply. Was, you said before, you know, that she wanted to set people at ease. She knew what it was like. You had to be on the set with Elizabeth Taylor. You do talk in many of your entries about, you know, the directors she worked with and her co-stars and things. And one question I just wanted to get from you was, of all the directors with whom she worked, like, who do you think she enjoyed working with the most, or who do you think she respected the most?
Well, I would say there were directors she enjoyed and there were directors she respected, and they didn't necessarily intersect.
Right.
I think in many cases they did, but in others they didn't. Who immediately comes to mind in terms of directors she respected but didn't necessarily like would be George Stevens, mm-hmm. who directed her in A Place in the Sun and Giant. And later on, a film called The Only Game in Town. But he was, by her account, rather tyrannical on the set, especially of Giant, less so with A Place in the Sun. And it sounds like she was often somewhat traumatized in the age when directors, patriarchal directors, could do that as a way of, without being called out, as a way of getting the performances they wanted. And so she did speak very well of him as a director in the ensuing years. And the evidence of his effectiveness is right there in both of those films, in her performances. But he doesn't sound like he's a very nice guy, let's put it that way, especially on Giant. He did stuff that sounds downright mean. And then there were directors that were just so creative for her and so enlivening, and that they just clicked so well that they had both a great time and the results were great. And the ultimate example of that, I would say, is with Mike Nichols on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That was the only time the two of them worked together. And what's miraculous is there's so many points of that film that are simply miraculous in terms of how well it turned out. And one of them, one of the key ones, is that it was Nichols' film debut as a director. He had great achievement as a stage director, but as there are other examples in her career where we can say stage directing and film directing are really very different. And if you have an affinity for one, it does not necessarily mean you have an affinity for the other. But she took a huge risk in insisting that, and she was powerful enough at that point to insist that Nichols be the director of that film. And they absolutely got along so well. I mean, there was a lot of, in the descriptions of the set, it sounds tremendously creative, and that Nichols would bring all sorts of inventive things to the set to help all of the four actors create these characters and embody them and live them thoroughly, which is, again, the results we see on the screen.
Yeah, you talk about the set decoration of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but what George and Martha's house looked like, and all the bric-a-brac and all the things that Mike Nichols put on there to let them inhabit this world.
Yes, and it's, you know, it's such an atypical set in that, you know, oftentimes art direction it seems kind of elementary. It's like it's signaling something like, oh, they're middle class or they're rich or they're struggling or, you know, whatever. With Virginia Woolf, it's like, well, they're intellectual and they're pack rats and they're everything. I believe every, you know, practically every piece of ephemera in that house has some meaning to them in the history of their marriage. I mean, that's really
Right.
an art direction. And it also had the effect of exciting the actors and
Yeah.
helping them create an interior life for the characters.
Yeah, that's the I just rewatched on the front of your book. I rewatched Father the Bride, and when you talk about the art direction, when Spencer Tracy goes in his house for the first time, you're like, got it, I understand,
Yeah,
got it
exactly.
done. It's everything is there, but Who's Afraid of Virginia
Right.
Woolf is so different.
Exactly.
So let's dive into some of the films, and let's get the Matt Kennedy hot take. The opinion on some of these films, and I'll just say the title, and you give the listeners, what you want them to think about that title. So let's start with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Well, okay, my opinionated guide. And please, I'm not, I don't want to be followed like a, like gospel. It's my second favorite Elizabeth Taylor performance after Virginia Woolf. And what they have in common, I think, is her phenomenal commitment to the role and the embodiment of the character she's playing, so that it comes down to my how believable she is as that person. Am I drawn into the world of Maggie the Cat largely by the power of that performance? Obviously, there's a lot of interesting, great stuff going on around her, but she has a lot of heavy lifting in that film, because of the censorship around it, specifically in the character that Paul Newman plays, who is her husband in the film. But what I love about that performance is her physicality. So she, just in the act of walking across the screen, walking across the set, I'm saying, now there goes a movie star. I mean, but there also goes Maggie the Cat. So you have that wonderful combination of that's Elizabeth Taylor, and that's the character she's playing. She's in service to the character and the drama, and she's fulfilling the obligations of her character beautifully, and she's still Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
And the physicality of the role is such, that she is a woman who is deeply frustrated at the lack of interest that her husband has developed for her sexually. And in a kind of method actor approach, and she wasn't a method actor, she's thinking, the character Maggie the Cat has a motivation, right? That's often key to many method performances. I'm motivated to want to achieve this in this scene. How do I go about doing it? With Maggie the Cat, what makes her motivation so delicious is that it's sex. She really, really wants to have an erotic life with her husband again. And how Taylor does that with her body, with her voice, with her face is so mesmerizing to me and so convincing. And she is aided, I mentioned this in the essay, she has three costumes in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and each one has a different relationship to her physicality. One is more restrictive and what you wear in public. Another one is her slip that she's only going to show in the presence of her husband. And then another is this chiffon flowing gown for the finish of the film, when her character actually experiences a kind of liberation, and a kind of triumph. So that I yeah I simply love that performance. And in fact, I've seen other Maggies, and I don't think they compare. I always see Elizabeth Taylor when I watch somebody else do Maggie the Cat. And that's actually quite a thing to say, given that, again, that version of the story of the play by Tennessee Williams was heavily censored and modified to fit a puritanical notion of sexuality in American film in the 1950s.
Right.
She overcomes.
Yeah, she sure does. She's
Yeah.
absolutely. Let's move on to Giant. Now you begin the entry on Giant with this question. How many ways do I love Giant? So what do you love about Giant?
Well, in that line, I realize I'm really delighted at the things you tease out of the book. Like I thought that line, and I thought, Do I even want to keep that line? It sounds like such a little fanboy. And then I just decided I'm gonna I just keep it. Just it's just fine. And I do feel very strongly about that film and that performance. And what I was sort of effusing about was that film is lovable to me in many, many ways. If I go straight to her performance, what I can say about it is that to me it is probably it is the performance over all others that in which I feel I'm getting the closest glimpse of Elizabeth Taylor off camera at her best. And I say that because of the character she plays, Leslie Benedict, is she's complex and she has blind spots and flaws, but she's ultimately a highly virtuous, moral person who has no patience and no tolerance for intolerance, for racism, for sexism, for classism. And in her way, in her subtle and yet powerful way, that character alters this huge Texas, huge, rich, influential Texas family, and by extension, all of Texas, and maybe even all of America. She is the voice of reason and compassion and love for fellow humans that throughout the entire film. And it actually, what's also miraculous about it is that she does this in a way that never feels preachy. It never feels self-serving or self-righteous. It's simply who this character is. She is one of the most compelling good people in film I've ever seen. You know, we often think, oh, you know, it's the villains that are fun to watch and fun to play and so on and so forth. It's like Leslie Benedict is just. You know what I you know I wish the world was full of Leslie Benedicts, and I don't find her cloying or overly sentimental or anything else. She's just a fabulous human being.
Yeah, that's the kind of movie in our age of reboots and remakes. I mean, there's no bottom in Hollywood. There's nothing that a producer won't try to remake. But even the Giant, they just know you can't
Oh.
remake. You can't. There's certain movies we're not going to do again, and you can't do Giant again.
I've never heard anybody even whisper the idea. It is pretty hard to imagine. Yeah.
So let's move on to, you mentioned this before, and I want to ask your opinion of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because for me that was the movie. So I was younger. It was on public television. I remember being a kid. I had never heard of her. I mean, I'd heard of her, but I'm like, who's this Elizabeth Taylor person? And I'm like, wasn't she married to this guy Richard Burton or more than one? And I was too young to understand the movie, but I watched it and I was like, wow, like this is no wonder I didn't understand the whole thing about the fake kid or any of the disillusion of their marriage. But I knew that I was watching, top shelf people. So what is it about her in that film that you keep coming back to?
Well, Dan, I have to ask. So you're saying that was the first Elizabeth Taylor performance you saw? Wow. Now there's an introduction all
Yeah,
right.
there's the, yeah, really. Talk about being told
You
it's
went
not
right
straight.
to the summit. Well, I have seen Virginia Woolf many, many times and found it endlessly entertaining as this fantastic tour de force. The most brilliant writing, the most brilliant acting, directing, cinematography, art direction, as we talked about, the score, the editing. I mean, everything about that film is just magnificent. And writing about it was actually a whole different thing because I could just, you know, in the times I'd seen it before, I could just wallow in its wonderfulness with other friends who have a similar high affection for it. And then, so to actually write about it was something of a challenge because I realized like, oh, you know, here I am gushing about its many virtues, but really it's a very, very disturbing story, right? I mean, this marriage is on the surface at least incredibly destructive and corrosive and so forth. And I'm just like bubbling along about, oh, isn't this is a great movie? And I need to realize that its impact could be very different for people who are, you know, seeing it for the first time. But in terms of Taylor, Nichols seemed to give her permission to basically be, for the first time in her career, I would say, a character actress. You know, she was aged, she was 32 in the 33 when the film was first being made. She played somebody probably in her mid-50s, alcoholic, deeply embittered, in a long-term marriage, which Taylor had not experienced at that point in her life. And she'd only been married to Burton for about a year when they made that film. And Nichols, through again the brilliance of the script and the direction and her co-stars, she lowered her voice. She wore these unflattering, outfits. She changed her walk. She lowered her center of gravity. And she writes about the sort of creative liberation that she experienced with Virginia Woolf, and how she didn't feel that she was Martha, but that she didn't draw necessarily on a lot from herself to be Martha, but that she somehow found this character through all of these means and lived it. So to watch her in this film is to watch her transform into something else, maybe more spectacularly than she ever did before or since. And the other thing about Virginia Woolf is how funny it is and how much humor she brings to it. It's humor with pain to it, with enormous pain. But and the other thing is that the layers in that film and that she brings out, George and Martha appear to absolutely loathe each other, and that the best thing they could possibly do is to end this marriage and go their separate ways. But again, through the brilliance of the writing and the playing, we learn that it's a strange and twisted way of actually demonstrating that they can't live without each other. That this is a deep and abiding love that they share. But my goodness, what a strange way to express it, And the brilliance of it is that at its drawing back as far as we can, I'm saying, is this a statement on marriage in general? Is it that broad that we can say George and Martha have achieved something extremely rare that we might even want to emulate on some level? Or is it just an exercise in marital sadomasochism? I just, you know, it's such a piece to ponder, you know.
It's such a train wreck, but you can't stop looking at it. I mean, that's
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
Right.
And yeah.
So let's go to another train wreck, not a film, but so to speak. But I have to ask about this. Was the first entry I read in your book? So when I got the book, I said I looked at the introduction and I said, all right, let me start going through these movies. And the first one I read was Cleopatra, and I wanted to read that one because I'm a great admirer of Joe Mankiewicz. I've read about him a lot, and your essay on Cleopatra mirrored my experience exactly. And I know this interview is about you, but I watched it. I kept waiting for it to get unbelievably terrible because all I had heard my whole life was that Herman Mankiewicz wrote the greatest movie ever made, Citizen Kane, and that Joe Mankiewicz made the worst movie ever made, his little brother, was Cleopatra. And I love your line. Here's another line I loved in your book. You say it's more about Hollywood than Egypt. So talk about Cleopatra, because like you, I do not find this movie to be a disaster at all.
Well, Dan, I hope that you and I are kind of on the cutting edge, if you will. That's being flattering, of a reassessment of this film, because there are others. We're not the only ones. There are others who have discovered that, hey, wait a minute, it's now a 60-year-old film, but that it's what's all the fuss about how terrible this film was, right? And what a train wreck, what a disaster. The script by a Mankiewicz, no less, is very witty, very has a kind of old Hollywood zing to it, and also brings out the drama and the psychology of the three main characters, Mark Antony, Caesar, and Cleopatra. But I think the film was so scandalous and so noteworthy in its day in terms of the budget out of hand, the affair that Taylor and Burton had on the set, and how that went public in a very gaudy way. The fact that it was the most expensive film ever made. I mean, all of this seemed to eclipse any kind of reasonable critical judgment of the film. So when it came out, there were some positive reviews, but many were quite negative. They said it's too long, it's, overstuffed, way overproduced. I mean, these sets just go on forever and ever. But I think this is one case, maybe the most significant in the entire book, one case where the passing of time allows us to reassess this film without all of that noise, right? Without all of the surrounding hoo-ha that engulfed it at the point that it was released in 1963. And now we can just curl up with it and watch it as a movie, right? And what do we see? We see a 4-hour epic that is unbelievably opulent to the eyes, incredibly impressive because that's all done in camera. We're, way before the age of CGI. And you go, did anyone ever really build a set that big? Are those really?
Elephants,
Right. I think they're the size of a football
right.
field. Are those really 5,000 extras that I'm seeing, or are they, dummies? And the answer is yes, it's all real. It all really happened. They really did put together a film that magnificent. And as for Elizabeth, she got generally quite bad reviews. So the film was praised in many ways, but very few people came out and said, actually, she does a pretty good job. What I see when I look at her in Cleopatra is I see someone assuming a very regal, appropriately, a very regal stance as Cleopatra. I see that she brings a lot of stillness to this performance that is not the case with her recent performances prior to that. And that she finds a kind of stature in Cleopatra through stillness physically. And I do think her voice in the film is sometimes problematic. There's a little bit of a rasp to it, or it's maybe hits the wrong chord or something. But then I lighten up and say, well, I try to be as generous as possible, and I say, well, she's speaking English, and it's depicting ancient Egypt, and people aren't going to, everybody doesn't have to sound like Rex Harrison and Richard Burton, who were these, mellifluous stage-trained actors that are surrounding her. So it's another case. I mean, well, actually, the ultimate case, I think, where if you want to see what a movie star looks like, watch Elizabeth Taylor in Cleopatra. And I would also tell people, don't be afraid of watching this movie. It's worthwhile, I'll
And
put
you
it
point
that
out that it actually it did make money. It did not
way.
end
And
the Red
yes,
Festival.
that's see now that's when I say, we're on the cutting edge, I think, of trying to put to rest the notion that it's either a bad movie and that it also lost money. It actually made money. It just took a very long time to make money because it was so darn expensive. But adjusted for inflation, it is currently the 46th highest box office in film history, which maybe doesn't sound very impressive, but if you think about how many films are out there in the world, 46th is actually extremely impressive.
Pretty good. That's pretty good. So, before we get to her later career, last individual movie I want to ask you about, and this is kind of timely. I just happened to read in the New York Times a week ago, David Mamet, the screenwriter and director. He has a new book about Hollywood, and they asked him what is the great American movie, and he said the great American movie is A Place in the Sun. It's kind of funny he said that, and then I'm like, oh, I knew I was going to talk to you. So let's talk about that, A Place in the Sun.
Yes, A Place in the Sun. That was directed by George Stevens. It was their first collaboration, the second being Giant. And the thing, again, I've always refracting this through her, right? One of the things that I would start with A Place in the Sun that is so astonishing is that when she made that film, she was 17. Now, if you see that film and didn't know that, I mean, when I saw it, I've seen it many times before writing about it, I would have guessed maybe 23, in the way she conducts herself, but also the way she, also the demands of the character. And so it's based on an American tragedy by Theodore Dreiser, and is essentially a love triangle. And Taylor plays a rich, pampered socialite who falls in love with a somewhat mysterious drifter, played by Montgomery Clift, who's also the nephew of a man who, a very wealthy man who owns the Eastman, is it? I think it's a swimwear company. But what she brings to the film is an absolute ardor for the Montgomery Clift character that is deeply moving and deeply convincing. And the significance again of this film is that she was being very definitely groomed for adult roles at MGM, but they were not very good properties. I mean, things like The Last Hangover and Conspirator and other films that she made immediately before A Place in the Sun, she was called upon to play grown-up emotions, but again, not very good stuff. With A Place in the Sun, she has this fantastic screenplay. She has this fantastic director. Montgomery Clift was a brilliant stage actor who had made a major impression on screen by the time they came together. And so I give a lot of credit to Clift and to Stevens for helping pull out of Elizabeth what she was capable of. And I don't want to give them so much credit that, to say that it's a Pygmalion type of relationship where they made her, they sculpted her into this great screen presence. All the work in the world on their part wouldn't have done a thing if she couldn't have done it herself. But it is it's a very significant film in her career that helped people stand up and take notice and say, this beautiful, this unearthly beautiful screen actress or screen star personality is it she's going to go the distance. She's a major star, and we now have the proof, and she's on to an indefinite adult career. It's a beautiful film in that the again it's like Virginia Woolf, so many departments that go into making a film were at the top of their game.
Everything aligned. All the planets aligned when that film was.
Yeah, exactly. All the planets aligned.
Absolutely. So those films I asked you about are ones that anybody would look, anybody that comes to this book is going to look up A Place in the Sun and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. But I want to ask you, so you had to be a completist to do this, right? What's a film that you watched for the sake of the book, or just to say that I've seen them all, that kind of surprised you, and you're like, well, I never thought that would be as good or as bad or as interesting?
Well, I think that the biggest surprise for me was a film called, and this is, I hope that for people who love Elizabeth Taylor, this will be part of the fun of the book, as you pointed out, that apart from the classics, there she did a lot of obscure stuff. And it's maybe obscure for a reason, like it's not very good or whatever. There's a lot of worthwhile stuff to explore that's lesser known in her career. And the film that really shocked me the most upon re-examination was it's called The Driver's Seat, and it comes out from 1974. I had seen The Driver's Seat. I saw it a couple of times on an old videotape at a friend's house, and it's that is no way to see that movie. I'm here to tell you, it was, sort of washed out, and we, the effect was blunted in that respect. And we were laughing at it. We saw, this is the craziest, weirdest movie. Can you believe Taylor, put herself in this? She's writhing around on the bed. She's like grabbing her breasts. She's making these unbelievably weird dialogue. And like, what is it? It's Italian with like stilted and like what is going on? Well, okay, that's how I came to the driver's seat when I knew I had to look at it again. I on Canopy, which is a streaming service that is available out there, there is a fresh print of the driver's seat. And the cinematographer on the driver's seat is Vittorio Storaro, who is a brilliant cinematographer who did the Conformist, and later on did Reds, and worked with Bernardo Bertolucci quite a bit. Well, to see a fresh remastered print of the driver's seat was to see a new movie. And it was watching it all by myself alone. It was really, really unsettling. It's a very disturbing, dark psychological thriller in which Taylor's character is on a rendezvous with death, you might say. And she plays this character in a fairly understated way. So the character she plays is, by, you know, conventional standards, insane. She's totally gone. But she doesn't play it in any kind of stock way. She's not like bugging her eyes and pulling her hair out or doing any kind of stock indication that of actors playing insane. She's understated. She takes the character and the dialogue and kind of works it in a subtle way, in an underhanded way, so that we're saying, did she just say that in a kind of deadpan, monotonous way? But what she said was just outrageous. I mean, it's just, you know, she's talking about she wants somebody to shoot her. She talks about sex pretty openly. That combined with the cinematography and the use of color and the use of shadows in that film, if you sort of surrender to it and watch it late at night, I guarantee it will have a disturbing effect. It will have an old movie quality that will linger with you. I'm not here to say it's a great movie, because there are other things in it that aren't quite, maybe don't quite work. But the combination of Vittorio Storaro and Elizabeth Taylor really putting herself out there with an interesting character and a vanity-free character is a sight to behold.
That's a great endorsement.
It came out in 1974, which is, you know, usually referred to as this desert in her career of, you know, one unfortunate movie after another that brought her down as an actress.
When you talk in your intro, you say that you're fascinated by her, what you call her career decline in her later films. And you say this as a quote of you, you say, quote, virtually all of her later films were deleterious in one way or another. So why do you think that was the case?
Well, you know, I think there were a lot of factors going on, and some were within her control, perhaps, and some weren't. In her post-Virginia Woolf career, which is really half her career. I mean, if you look at her actual output, and yet very often accounts of her career end with Virginia Woolf. It's like, oh, we won't talk about, you know, Hammersmith is out. We won't talk about, you know, The Bluebird. But again, in terms of output, she was far from being done. But there were all these different factors. One, I think, is that her marriage to Richard Burton was becoming more and more destructive. There was a lot of alcohol involved. And so they, as a screen team, seemed to work less and less well as their partnership went on in their marriage. There's also, I think, a kind of downward spiral that happens with major stars where, you know, you have one box office failure with bad reviews. And then that means that the next film is going to maybe not have quite the same budget that the previous one did. And maybe the people involved aren't going to be quite as on top of their game. And then that one also, that does even worse than the previous one. You know, and you've got this downward spiral. And I think that definitely happened with her. And also, she was by Hollywood standards, she was veering toward middle age. And in the old days, and I'm happy to say this is really changed in Hollywood. You know, an actress might be done with major stardom, with leading roles, by the time she's 40. And Taylor turned 40 in 1972, which is right when her career was struggling. That really has changed, and I for the better. I mean, women in particular have viable careers way past that. What Taylor did was choose to maintain her leading lady status as a star, but that meant that as opposed to so well that meant that the films themselves got lower in budget and quality and ambition. But another option for her that she didn't take was, I'm going to start playing people's mothers in high budget films, right? She chose to remain a star while, as you know, to quote Norma Desmond, the pictures got small. I mean, that really
Right.
was the case for her. And but I found tremendous riches in seeing some of these later films where clearly the material to her surrounding her wasn't so wonderful, but I can see her doing what she could with it
Yeah.
and bringing her magnetism to it and walking away looking pretty good if the rest of the film didn't. Let's
Yeah,
put
you
it that
point
way.
out, like in your essay about Night Watch, I think it is, you say, like, she never phoned it in. She always delivered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Night Watch is, I'd say, kind of a mediocre thriller.
Right.
It's a horror movie. It does pick up toward the end. But she brings home a nice, meaty, you know, satisfying, old-fashioned movie star performance. Yeah.
So you talk about also at the end of the book, in addition to the 56 films, you talk about, some theatrical performances she did. I love the stage reading with her and Richard Burton. I had no idea that
Yeah.
existed, right? That was really cool. But what were some of the interesting, post-film, if you will, like appearances or things that you discovered about her that you would tell people to try to find a recording of if there is one to read about?
Well, she had, I hesitate to even call it a theatrical career, but she did do stage appearances sporadically. Yeah. And so the biggie would be The Little Foxes in 1981. Her film career was pretty much like grinding to a halt at that point. And she was, you know, antsy and wanted to, do some acting, and she appeared in this Broadway production of The Little Foxes and did very well. Reviews were strong. She had a wonderful cast, including Maureen Stapleton and others that you know brought to life this really rich Lillian Hellman melodrama. And she loved that experience, apparently. I was able to see it thanks to a bootleg video that a collector had. It's not available commercially. And I saw a performance that I don't know what the date was, but it was during the New York run. And she was absolutely terrific. There's a moment when she enters where there's that kind of gasp of, oh my God, that's Elizabeth Taylor in a Broadway drama. And then she just absorbs into the ensemble. And I think that comes back to the idea of she was fun, right?
Yeah.
She made sure that she did not turn this into a vanity project where they're all supporting her. That she very much came to that, ultimately came to it as best as she could, as we're an ensemble and we're, you know, we have a common goal here.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily to make me the star. I mean, that's the feeling that I get in that performance. And there are moments in The Little Foxes where, you know, she has the kind of command that I w would say goes all the way back to Maggie the Cat in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Her other stage appearances, I was not able to see, and I don't know that they exist in terms of, you know, ever being recorded. Private Lives by Noel Coward is something that she and Burton did after she did The Little Foxes. And that is, all the reviews of that and the accounts of it are extremely negative, and that it was actually kind of a sad spectacle to watch the two of them way after they'd divorced twice, and were sort of carting out their public images and playing on the double meanings of the dialogue, and not really being very disciplined actors at that point.
It comes across as gimmicky, right? I mean,
Yeah, gimmicky. Yeah, exactly. Sort of stunt casting and
right.
of two of them in that show, in that play. And a friend of mine actually saw it, and he said he was pretty kind. He said, yeah, it was fluffy, but they looked like they were having a good time, and he actually had a fond memory of it, as opposed to that was just painful to watch. Burton was near his death. He was in late stage alcoholism at that point. So yeah, it was emotionally, I think it was difficult for her. The other things that she did on stage were short term, in some cases a single night. The stage reading from 1964, which I would have given anything to have,
Oh, really?
I sure wish we had a record of that. But she also did a stage reading of Love Letters at the very, very end of her career, her last professional appearance in 2007, with James Earl Jones, and by all accounts, she was fantastic. And it wasn't just because you're Elizabeth Taylor.
Right. Yeah. I know. It's like everything is recorded now, and you're like, nobody hit record on this. Nobody thought this
Yeah,
was a good idea to
well,
record.
it maybe,
Right.
but maybe my book will bring out some other bootleg copies. I sure hope so.
So, last question here. That you have a timeline in the beginning of the book, which is really useful because you go back and see what was going on in Taylor's life, parallel to her artistic life. And you point out that, she died in 2011. She was survived by her brother, four children, 10 grandchildren, four great grandchildren. And I was just curious, and I don't know the answer to this. Have any of these people done anything to like preserve her legacy? Like, do they do anything to kind of like maintain this and kind of keep her films alive?
Absolutely. In her lifetime, she founded the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation, and which is most people probably know of, as and she co-founded Foundation for AIDS Research, aka AMFAR, with the goal of raising money for people with AIDS in service to research and education, care, etc. And she was a fierce advocate for people with AIDS, especially in the 1980s, when public attitudes were horrific in terms of care and compassion for people with AIDS. That lives on in the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation. And I sound like a promotion, but I'm not trying to be. And her children and grandchildren are in various ways involved, and are continuing to do advocacy on behalf of the AIDS Foundation. And if you visit the what's called the House of Taylor, which is a sort of umbrella term for her line of fragrances as well as jewelry, which she also developed as a businesswoman beginning in the 1980s, that in which that money went into AIDS work. If you visit the House of Taylor, you will see that her legacy via her family and via the staff and the board there is very strong. And so she's not simply being remembered as an actress and a celebrity, but also as a great philanthropist. And what she believed in and what she devoted herself to philanthropically is still very much alive. Yeah.
Great. Great. On Elizabeth Taylor, an opinionated guide. It's available everywhere. And if you love the films of Elizabeth Taylor, or like we said, classic Hollywood, you do not want to miss this. It's published by Oxford University Press. You can get it wherever you find books. There's a link to it on our New Books Network website. Matthew Kennedy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Dan, thank you. This has been great fun. I will tell you just if I may, in parting, this is the book is actually we're speaking in January of 2024. The book is due out in April, but it's available to pre-order now. And this is my very first interview about the book. So I want to thank you for I hope starting the ball rolling.
Sure. Sure.
Getting
Well,
open up.
your enthusiasm comes through in the interview, but also for all the listeners out there, it really comes through on the page. I mean, this is a movie that you drink coffee as you read it, and you laugh at certain lines, and then you're like, "What's he going to say about the next thing?" That's what I mean. It was like listening to a fan, but not a fanboy, go on about somebody who he's admired for a long time. So well done.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that feedback very much.